Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is the chair of the society, Robert M. Ellis, who's going to be talking to us today about politics and the Middle Way. Hello, Robert. Welcome back to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello, Barry. Good to be here.
Okay. Well, could we maybe start, Robert, by you just giving us a bit of background and tell us a bit how you first became interested in politics and why you think it's an important issue and how it's related to the Middle Way, etc.
Okay. Well, my interest in politics really has grown out of philosophy and development of Middle Way philosophy. It's grown out of it partly because also I'm an A-level teacher. I've been an A-level teacher of philosophy for some time, and I teach politics as well. So I've moved into politics as well. So I've had the opportunity to discuss political issues at some length with students, which has been very stimulating in various ways. In terms of philosophy and Middle Way philosophy, it seemed to me more and more that politics is an area of life that we just can't neglect, and the practice of the Middle Way includes politics, and you can't really separate politics as much as people often do from other areas of practice, you know, sort of personal practice. So I think, you know, neither can we wholly neglect it, nor should we be so obsessed by it that we don't think about the other dimensions of life. But you know, it's there, it's part of what we need to address. So hence I've developed various ideas about ideologies and the ways in which we can work with ideologies rather than just getting swept up by absolute interpretations of ideologies.
Okay, well, let's jump in then. So what is politics and what are political ideologies?
Well, I'd see politics as being a debate about how we should run society and what sort of formal mechanisms, obviously laws and institutions, we should have to run our society. And obviously that usually takes place in the forum of the nation state, but there's also international politics and local politics and so on. But more broadly than that, there's the debate about how we should run things. And that obviously takes us into political philosophy as a sort of broad discussion about what sort of values we should use and how we should apply them in deciding what's the right way to run things. So obviously that can include everything from, you know, specific policies like, say, you know, how to run the economy or drug policy or something, back to what sort of institutions we should have at all. Should we have a democracy at all? And those sorts of questions. Yeah. Now, what was the other part of your question?
Yeah, what are political ideologies?
Well, ideologies are they're sets of beliefs about how we should act in politics. There I would very much want to separate out the dogmatic or absolute elements of ideologies in politics from the values, the more flexible values that we may have. So examples of classic ideologies are, say, liberalism or socialism or conservatism, and those are roughly allied to parties, but only very roughly, and the relationship between ideologies and parties is complicated. But they are obviously influences on the parties of those names, and those influences may have dogmatic elements which I think are unhelpful, but they're also important aspects of those ideologies that do address conditions in different ways that I think we need to recognise.
So how do dogmatic or metaphysical beliefs affect politics, and why is that unhelpful?
Okay, well, it's about having a rigid belief which represses other beliefs. So if you think about all the beliefs that we tend to hold, you know, usually if they arise in the context of our experience, then they're addressing some condition or other. That, you know, the beliefs are there for a reason, they're connected to some experiences, and therefore they're going to be helpful in some ways. They're going to address something. But where I see metaphysical or dogmatic beliefs as being different from that is that they are They're purely abstract. They're just representations in our minds that are mainly there for purposes of power, and power is very relevant to politics, and they repress alternatives. So when a belief becomes dogmatic, it sort of keeps out awareness of other factors and other alternative possibilities. So, for example, if you have a very strong allegiance to liberty and the value of freedom in politics, and you exclude the importance of justice and equality, or vice versa, then you're going to miss something out. So you get kind of extreme libertarians, for example, who don't think justice is worth thinking about, and you get extreme socialists, say, who don't think liberty is worth thinking about, and both of those can make sort of opposing types of mistakes, in my view, because they just don't listen to what's helpful in what the other side's saying.
Yeah.
So you get a polarized debate where nobody listens to each other.
And do you think that, say, the first past the post systems that currently are in use in the UK and the US, do you think they, to an extent, encourage people to think more dogmatically? You either belong to this party and think this way, or belong to that party. There seems to be not that much grey area.
Well, that's certainly the case that increases polarisation, I think, or encourages it. Yeah, because the institutions reinforce it. And of course, if only two parties have the opportunity to, genuine opportunity to get into power, as is the case certainly in the US and largely in the UK as well, then only two voices tend to emerge. And even though those parties may be broad churches, there's still kind of a dominant voice which has to be in charge in those parties for them to rule. And that means other voices tend to get excluded, certainly, and people tend to cluster around those two voices, and they turn into rigid extremes because of the group identity that's involved, particularly. And I certainly see that, seem to see that quite a lot in, well, it seems to arise a lot in discussions between Americans of opposing camps, whether you know, they identify with one group or another, when one set of assumptions is against another.
Yeah. Is no one ideology better than another? Does the middle way imply supporting any one ideology?
I don't think it does. You can't generalise to the extent that you can say the middle way means we should be conservatives or socialists or greens or whatever it might be, just because each of those ideological traditions does address certain conditions. So, for example, the tradition of socialism and the importance of justice recognised by socialism makes us look at the conditions of the poor and what effect that has on society and how to help the disadvantaged. And that's important. But we can't just say, because of that, well, socialism is right and conservatism is wrong, because if we did that, we'd be excluding the other insights offered by other ideologies. So that's a rather different, though, situation from where the individual needs to be in making political choices. So when you go into a polling station and have to put your cross on the ballot, or however you do your voting, you have to make a decision. And that's always the case in life, that there are specific decisions we have to make, and politicians in government have to make particular decisions. So at that point, they have to, you know, freeze frame their judgment. They have to close some of the doors and say, well, in these circumstances, this is the best option. So I think we need to make political choices, but that doesn't mean that one ideology is the right one for all time and in all circumstances.
Well, why are you then a member of the Green Party if the middle way doesn't imply support of a particular ideology?
Because my particular circumstances in the particular culture and time and place and so on that I'm in, the Green Party seems to be addressing a set of conditions more than other parties. Very important conditions, I think. So there's a kind of elephant in the room, as far as I can see, where the conditions in modern society in the UK and other places are at stake. And that's the growth economy, which is hugely unsustainable, the accelerating levels of debt, both personal and governmental debt, which goes with that growth economy, the CO2 emissions and global warming. You know, those are all conditions which are really hardly being addressed, not nearly sufficiently by the mainstream parties, in my opinion. So for that reason, I think it's overwhelmingly important to support a party that is addressing, you know, looking at the elephant in the room rather than avoiding it. So that's why I'm a member of the Green Party. But that doesn't mean that I think the Green Party is right about everything. I think that on balance, it's got policies which are addressing conditions far more than most of the others, and therefore it becomes an urgent priority, a practical priority, to give political support to it. It doesn't mean, you know, obviously you'd have to look at parties in other countries. I don't know whether the same balance is true in other situations, you know, and obviously also what political choices you make depend on where you come from and what your situation is. And so it may be that somebody emerging from a far right background or something, you know, maybe it would be an advance for them to vote for the Conservatives in some cases. You know, they couldn't really grasp some of the other conditions or engage with them, but it's still, yeah, there are better options for each of us from wherever we come from.
Okay. Isn't the middle way some sort of, this has been said to me a few times, that it's liberal, it's sort of a wishy-washy compromise, leading us towards the middle of the political spectrum?
Yeah. Well, I think often it does in practice, in the sense that the middle of the political spectrum may often be avoiding dogmatic extremes that fail to address conditions. So if you take, for example, the Liberal Democrats in UK politics, they do have as part of their kind of ideological basis a sort of mixture of addressing justice and addressing freedom. So those are two sort of key values that you find obviously emphasised towards the left and towards the right. And that's an ideology which is often called modern liberalism, and which you also find in the Democrats in the US. So that's, you know, I think that modern liberals do address a lot of conditions for that reason. The reason why I don't directly support them at the moment is because I don't think they address the green issues sufficiently. And as far as liberalism in general is concerned, it's also possible to be a kind of extreme liberal. It's possible to, for example, overemphasize freedom at the expense of other kinds of values.
And then just taking it the other way, couldn't the middle way be seen as conservative by challenging big ideology?
Yeah, I think there is an important connection which perhaps those on the left need to appreciate, particularly between, well, what we might call Burkean conservatism and the middle way. So Burke was a, you know, historical figure in the UK, well, in English politics anyway. He was the first person really to emphasise the need to address a range of conditions and to be sceptical about the big answers. And big plans, which, you know, if you've got an all-encompassing idea of how things ought to be and what policies we ought to follow, which is, you know, rigidly pursued, then you can end up making big mistakes. You know, the kind of Three Gorges Dam kind of example, you know, where you've got a big project and there's all kinds of side effects of that project, and it's a matter of over-arrogant presumption that leads us, you know, into those mistakes without looking enough at those possible side effects. So conservative is, in that sense, in that Burkean sense, is a good kind of caution, yeah, against this kind of arrogance. And but on the other hand, obviously conservatism has a number of strands in it, and a lot of people who call themselves conservatives these days, in a party sense at least, often, they may pay lip service to Burkeanism, but they don't seem to me to be putting it to practice very consistently quite often. And there's obviously also big neoliberal elements in the Conservative Party in the UK, and also the Republicans in the US. And also, one can, if you have allegiance to tradition, as conservatives often tend to do, it's quite possible for tradition itself to become a dogma, and, you know, you select perhaps the key elements of a tradition that are advantageous to you, and you neglect the others, and so tradition becomes a kind of source of authority rather than a helpful resource from the past.
Just following this theme a little bit more, Isn't the idea of uniting people, though, and overcoming divisions basically socialist?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's central in the Middle Way, Middle Way is about overcoming conflicts, overcoming conflictional ideologies, and that's where socialism has been valuable. So, you know, if you go back to the 19th century before socialism really arose, you know, society was deeply divided in industrialized countries between the working classes and the bourgeoisie. And socialism has helped us address that. It's produced much more equal societies, particularly in Scandinavia, which is kind of the model of how socialism might work, and even in the UK. So the welfare state has had a big, you know, contribution to that, and the development of universal education and so on, and all those really are to the credit of socialist movements, or at least social democratic movements. So socialism is, I think, has addressed a whole lot of new conditions, but again, you can absolutize that. And well, we all know about, you know, the effects of extreme socialism in the case of Marxism and communism, and how if you try to impose equality to too great an extent and neglect liberty, then, you know, you get rid of people's initiative for a start, and their autonomy and their ability to make their own judgments and therefore to develop as individuals. So socialism needs to be, you know, the insights of socialism, I think, need to be held in balance with those of other ideologies.
Sure, yeah. What's been interesting with my last few questions is that the middle way, well, I suppose it depends partly from where you're coming from, but that the middle way can encompass perspectives from liberal, from conservative, from socialist, you know, from the green sort of traditions too. I mean, now, you've been quite influenced recently in this regard by the American psychologist Jonathan Haidt and his value foundations. Could you just expand on that a little bit?
Sure, yes. Well, Jonathan Haidt's value foundations, I think, are very helpful in helping us to see how much, well, in a way, we all have the kind of basis of different ideologies in our thinking. And so he found six value foundations in people's, you know, views and ideas and beliefs and so on across the world, really. And those were fairness, care, liberty, loyalty, authority, and sanctity. So, I mean, some of those are obviously emphasized by one ideology or another, or a combination of them emphasized. So he says that fairness and care are emphasized by socialists, and liberty is obviously emphasized by libertarians. Loyalty and authority and sanctity tend to be emphasized more by traditional conservatives. And again, you can go into more detail there if you, you know, if you want to look at different strands of different ideologies and nationalism and so on, all emphasize other aspects of those value foundations. So in a sense, we are all of the ideologies, I think, in that sense. So it's easy, for example, to those on the left of the spectrum to decry the kind of loyalty, authority, and sanctity as values. But I think, you know, we all have those. We all have loyalty to our friends and family, for example. That's a sort of fact of human life. And we do obey authority, you know, the authority of the state, for example, the authority of the police, the authority of the tax authorities, you know, whatever it is, unless we're criminals, then we can, authority is going to be important to our values. And sanctity, again, that there's a kind of aesthetic value at stake. I think, you know, if somebody, you know, goes into my local stream and pours a load of sewage into it or something like this, then my sense of sanctity is outraged, you know. That's part of our actual emotional responses. So I think it's important for us to recognize those elements. So even if you don't feel you're a conservative, there are things we share, or you will share, with conservative kinds of values, and things we can learn from those values, that the aspects of human life that they highlight. And Jonathan Haidt, I think, is very helpful in exploring all that, and he tells a kind of personal story as well in his book. The way, you know, he tells the story of how he started off as a left winger, assuming that fairness and care were what it was all about, really. And he also then encountered that the, you know, other people were unable to kind of comprehend, you know, alternative approaches, and gradually came to recognise through his research that those other kinds of values were important and address certain conditions. I mean, where I disagree with Jonathan Haidt is just that particularly he identifies those value foundations with ethics in general, and I don't think they account for ethics in general. They're more about political values as far as I'm concerned. And
okay.
Ethics in general involves judgment in general, so there are wider issues with ethics in general. It's not just ethics can't be reduced to merely to social ethics.
Mm-hmm. What's your answer to people who say, why should we vote?
Why should we vote? Well, obviously there's a classic answer there that it's part of your civic responsibility as a citizen. But also, you know, if you don't vote, you're not going to have a relative effect on the political life of your country, your context, whatever it is. So it's a way of contributing. It's a way of also kind of being decisive in your personal contribution and making the best of that opportunity to make a contribution to the values that are used to make decisions in your locality. So, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a sort of absolute to always vote. There may be occasions where it's not so important, but so I suppose I'm certainly resistant to kind of people who absolutize the sort of anarchist position that underlies not voting. Yeah, you know, when they tend to say, well, if voting made a difference, then they would have abolished it long ago, that kind of way of talking. But obviously voting does make a difference. It's an incremental difference. It's not an absolute difference. You're not going to change everything all at once by voting, but you are going to contribute to changes in helpful directions. So it's worth doing. Yeah. For that reason.
It does seem, though, that political apathy and alienation to an extent appears to be on the rise. I could be wrong there, but what do you put that down to, and what steps could we do to rectify that?
Well, I think the major thing there is political education that people often just don't engage with politics. And part of that is also that they don't find politics meaningful enough. So if people are introduced to politics, political ideas, and they engage in discussions about them at an early age, then that may be, you know, help people to get into it at an earlier age. And I think a kind of sort of fake neutrality in education may be partly responsible for that sometimes, that teachers are sometimes afraid to put forward a political view for discussion, say, or to really engage students in political issues, because they're afraid of being seen as biased or something of that kind. But there's a need to be provocative sometimes where politics is concerned, and not to be afraid to explore things from a particular point of view.
And then just moving on to politicians. They tend to get a lot of bad press. You know, often hear comments like they'll never answer the question, or they can't be trusted. But are they to an extent caught between a rock and a hard place? Because if they're too specific, then they'll alienate a large proportion of the people they're trying to reach. Or if they're too vague, yeah, I mean, and then they get criticised in the way I've just mentioned. I imagine it's not an easy job.
I'd agree with that. Yes, it's for some reason, I think maybe people fail to think of politicians as individuals in some way. They perhaps think of them as kind of ciphers or symbols of the state or something, but they are also individuals, and we have to recognise that as part of the conditions we're working with. And also, even if politicians are, for example, privileged, or, you know, even if the conditions which should have allowed them to get into power aren't that fair, they've still got awkward decisions to make, and they still, on the whole, need our support in engaging with those difficult decisions, I think. So, I mean, in the current UK situation, you know, I decry the electoral system, for example, and I don't think that David Cameron was elected as the new Prime Minister on a fair basis, but nevertheless, that's the system we have, and for the moment, I have to continue to pay my taxes and, you know, to some indirect extent, support the government. So we need to, I suppose, make come to terms with that, and not. It doesn't help to kind of accuse the politicians of lying or to vilify them or demonise them and fail to sympathise with the personal input as well to their decision making. Or I think perhaps another thing's often assumed there is that politicians always have bad motives or they're always self-interested. But again, that's against the principle of charity. So the principle of charity suggests when we get ambiguous arguments or ambiguous claims, we should assume that people have the best motives available, because if we do that, we're more likely to get better results in the end than if we assume that everybody is out to get us or everybody is cheating or whatever it is. So unless we have good evidence that they're cheating, I think we need to assume that they've got good motives.
Okay. So looking at it from the broadest perspective, Robert, would you say that democracy is the, what was it Churchill said, it's the
least worst?
It's the least worst of the options out there. To what extent would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I'd agree with Churchill on that one. It's democracy has all sorts of problems, but it's developed for good reasons, in a sense, in that it addresses certain conditions, and key among those is making sure that people are on board to at least a fair extent. I mean, you're not going to keep everybody happy, but democracy tries to avoid having major sections of society that are alienated from the government or from the policies that are being followed. They've given some kind of consent to them, even if they've lost the election. So that's why I think democracy is important and why we need to continue to make our democracy more effective. But there are lots of different ways of organising democracy, and it depends to some extent on your electoral system. And that's obviously one reason why I'm against first-past-the-post system we have in the UK and the similar one in the US, where a lot of voices are excluded, and that's going to lead to more alienation and division and polarisation, more than we need to have. So I think some kind of reformed and balanced electoral system, like the German model, seems to me to be a good one to follow there, where you've got what's known as the additional member system, and you do have sort of locally members who are identified with a particular locality, a particular constituency, but there are also additional members that balance out the representation of the parties in Parliament. So democracy can work in better or worse sorts of ways. If you compare democracy to, I suppose benevolent dictatorship would be the ideal that people might have as an alternative. Benevolent dictatorship might well, for example, sort out global warming much better than democracy is doing at the moment. But that's just a theory. We have no idea whether that would actually be the case. If we were to appoint a world dictator, we would have no control over whether they actually did that or not. So it's too much of a risk. democracy is the least worst option from an epistemological point of view, of anything else, that taking into account our degree of ignorance and uncertainty as humans, and that our embodied situation, it's a way of working with all that rather than just developing an absolute ideal of what ought to happen and trying to make that happen. That's the kind of dogmatic metaphysical way of doing things. Democracy has contributed a lot, I think, to undermining that dogmatic power-based way of approaching things.
Sure. Well, that was great, Robert. That was really interesting. Thanks for talking to me today.
Okay, thank you, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.